Well, welcome to this month's Ask Europe Doctor. My name's Andrew Murray. From the 7:30 until the end of the show, callers are invited to call in with any questions related or unrelated to this month's subject of kind of mixed topic, really. It's a little bit of economics, a little bit of greed, corporate greed, and idealism, and a couple of characters from the mid-1850s who had some very visionary thoughts about such concepts as the biosphere and noosphere are going to be woven into the discussion. It's very much a point at this point in time where I think as a species we are definitely getting more and more aware of our surroundings. The internet has made it extremely easy to find out a lot of information about a lot of different things. Sometimes some of it's erroneous, other times it's revelationary. So there's plenty of data to support lots of arguments on both sides of the coin. If someone wants to argue something, you can get on the internet and you can find a lot about it, sometimes erroneous, sometimes accurate. But the idea is that we have got more freedom than ever. We're not confined, as it were, to libraries to sift and trawl through volumes. We've got, at the push of a button, the chance to find out all sorts of things that we would never have had access to. And so, therefore, dissemination of knowledge has become much freer. And unlike in times past, when academia and education was reserved for those people who had power, influence, money, hereditary money that would have kept them in the right position, anybody with a desire to know more or a passion to know more about a subject can get on the internet and fairly quickly come to a fairly accurate opinion about a lot of things. And like I said, you know, sometimes information on the internet is not accurate and can be misleading. I found in the past here with talking with Dr. Pete and looking at lots of research articles and clinical trial data and all sorts of controlled double-blind studies and placebo-controlled studies and randomized studies and even studies that are seemingly scientific can actually be misleading and erroneous. So just look at all the data, folks, and look at it objectively. And you can generally find the fault in some papers, and you can more often than not, you know, if there's money involved in it, just follow the money, and that will also lead you to the direction that will reveal some of the truth about it that you may not have read or seen. So, like I said, this month's subject is going to be a medley of things, but with economics and greed at the heart of it. And as a species, we are probably more so now than ever, more relaxed, if you like, and there we have less, and I don't mean this from a physiological perspective, but less stress on us to survive because things are available in convenience stores and we don't have to hunt them now. We don't have to grow them. We don't have to have those skills. We're becoming less physical as we become more cerebral, perhaps, and things are there, just like Amazon will deliver it. Not that I agree with Amazon, but Amazon will deliver it to your door. You don't have to go out and get it anymore. And as long as you're earning a wage, there is some disposable income at your disposal to do that. So that's part of this evening is the I just want people that are listening to the show just to really sit back and think about what I'm going to say, because I get my head into it a lot. And it still strikes me as kind of mind-blowing when I read these things and get into it in more depth and truly expose myself to it. It just highlights to me how little most people probably know or understand about what I'm going to say. And I think the largest excuse that you hear from people is, I'm too busy to get involved. And that's true enough. You know, most folks here are working two jobs. Sometimes people work in three part-time jobs just to make ends meet. And the cost of everything has skyrocketed, and our attention is being captivated and by working so much so to make ends meet that we have much less time now, I think, than in the past to get involved in politics and to organize and steer the government the way that we, the people, want it to go. And I think the opposite happens, where we're completely blindsided by the economics of the day that we live in and the debt that most people live in, that they just don't have the time or the want to get involved with politics, not understanding that it's the root cause of the reason that we're in the debt and the poverty that we're in. So it's very much up to us to get involved. And getting involved with local government is probably the easiest first step that people can do to try and make positive change in their area. That's why I'm so pleased, really, to be in Humboldt and this part of California anyway, especially. There's a lot of grassroots movements. There's a lot of independent, free-thinking people. There's a lot of people with a lot of talents. Sometimes they don't get expressed as much as they could. But ultimately, there's a lot of people in this area, largely, that have a much more eclectic outlook and a much more free thinking and questioning and, examining kind of spirit in them, which I think is very important in order to keep open society as open society and not controlled by the ever-increasing government that we have. So, excuse me, Dr. Pete is on the line, and I know that most people who've listened to the show certainly understand where Dr. Pete is coming from. He's a very open-minded free thinker who has spent most of his life in academia researching, after doing his PhD, researching subjects that are increasingly being brought to light to be showing us a very different way to live and a very different perspective that he has on many different subjects. So I will be joined by Dr. Pete here in a moment. I wanted to start with a kind of monologue that I drew up during yesterday and today as a kind of basis for the show, but always we'll get Dr. Pete's perspective on it, because it's very different from how you would normally think he would answer things. So I'd be quite interested to hear how he's going to respond. I never really plan this with him. We never really talk about how we're going to answer the questions or what I'm going to say and what he's going to say. He's always very ad-lib and extremely, extremely lucid. I think he's 81 or 82 now. Maybe he'll correct me when he comes on. But he is more lucid and with it than a lot of 20 or 30-year-old academics that I've known and know. So anyway, what I wanted to say was that from an economic perspective, then, let's just look at greed. Coupled with runaway inflation and the resulting decline in spending power of industrialized nations, it fuels this chemically altered world that we live in. Now, this economic uphill struggle to support sustainability and organically raised foods creates a sense of loss for an otherwise enhanced and healthy environment, both psychologically and physically, for us all. So just bear with me on that for a second, both psychologically and physically for us all. So it's a holistic approach to this, psychologically and physically. Now, the cost of living in real terms from 1950 to the present time, for three particular metrics that I'm going to look at, which are very standard in this day and age, we can relate to it in the 1950s and we can relate to it today. One's average family income, the second is an average car cost, and the third is an average median house price. Okay, so in 1950, the average family income was $3,300, and the average car cost $1,500. And the median house price was about $7,300. So your average car cost would be half of your average income, and your average house price would be just over two times your family income. That was back in 1950. Now, when you hear people talking, you hear the 20-year-olds or 30-year-old millennials talking about price of living, the cost of things, and their parents saying, well, in our day, it was a lot cheaper. And their parents' parents, their grandparents, saying it was even better in our day when America was great. And I know it was. It's not so great now, unfortunately, folks, but that's another subject. So from the 30s to the 50s, things were really doing very well for the states. And from the 50s even to the 70s, things were going really well. Around about 1973, things started rapidly increasing in price, and the average wealth of people started rapidly declining. And it's funny, when you look at the national debt that also took a rapid spike, actually much more around the 90s, but after the oil problems in the 70s and the price of gold being fairly high, then you'll find that things started shifting as various other products became the kind of leading market dominators. So anyway, those three costs, the average income for the home, the average income, $3,300, the average car was $1,500, and the average median house price was $7,300. So now these important metrics allow relative comparisons across time now when we form ratios from them. So the home price income against income was 2.2, and the car cost against income was 0.45. Now, in 2014, the U.S. Census Bureau showed these following values. The average family income was $51,000, the average car cost $31,000, and the median home price was now $188,000. So, as a ratio here, an index, the home price to income has suddenly gone to 3.7, which is 1.68 times what it was in 1950. So no wonder people can't get on the housing ladder. And this was the same when I was young in the 80s. I know that then people were just able to get onto the housing market ladder. And by the 1990s, it was becoming very obvious that it was getting very expensive to get your initial down payment for a mortgage anyway in England, that previously had been quite attainable by people 20 or 30 years ago. Okay, the engineer's telling me there's a caller on the line. Well, let's go with the caller as he's here, but generally I wouldn't, but let's take this caller. Caller, where are you from and what's your question?
Oh, yeah, greetings from San Francisco.
Okay, what's your question, caller?
Well, a couple of different things. I heard you talking about the standard of living from 1973, and that corresponds to a point when Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, I don't know if you've ever interviewed Frances Moore LePay. She wrote the book Food First, Beyond the Myth of Scarcity. And there's a section in there where she describes that when Nixon took us off the gold standard, all of a sudden the rich of the world figured out that they better invest in tangible things, which would be hedges against inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started buying land and specifically buying the highest quality land in order to have the highest hedge against inflation. And so, for example, the starvation in Bangladesh was because the super rich of the world started buying the agricultural land at the foothills of the Himalayas.
Yep.
And they drove millions of people off the land so that, they say that the erosion off the Himalayas is going to go on for another 10,000 years.
Right.
And so all of that erosion is going to turn into good topsoil at the foot of the Himalayas.
Further down, yeah.
And so that's going to be the best agricultural land in that region of the world, and so to feed the people out there, they'd better buy that land. And so the starvation in Bangladesh was because all of those farmers were driven down to the ocean, where they were not familiar with gaining lifestyle or anything like that. So that was specifically tied to the Nixon removing the U.S. dollar from the gold standard in, I think that was 1972. And there's another book that also gives some attribution to that, and that's called The Making of the President series.
Right.
And that Making of the President series, if you look for the one for 1972, that also talks about the re-election year of Richard Nixon. And if you look in the index under gold, it gives a very similar breakdown on the economy, and as it becomes basically very manipulated. The other thing I was going to raise, and my ears perked up when you were talking about people having deliveries, Amazon and whatnot. Mm-hmm. If you read old books, 100-year-old books, 50-year-old books, biographies of the 30s or anything like that, a whole lot of people, especially kids, orphaned kids, were making money being like delivery boys. They'd go down to the grocery store and deliver packages mm-hmm. and groceries for the little old ladies or whatever. They'd make decent little income for a teenage kid was being a delivery boy. And the only trouble with Amazon doing that is they're doing it on a global, in a global sense. And so the new generation of kids are no longer able to make money on the side being delivery boys. And what's even worse with Amazon is that the payment is done electronically, which means that every small town that gets a delivery, that money is sucked out of town right away. Mm-hmm. It no longer stays in, Ukiah. It no longer stays in Shreveport, Louisiana, or anywhere else. That money gets sucked to the corporate headquarters of Amazon.
Yeah.
And so the local economy is decimated, where a delivery boy becomes a stable part of the local economy.
Sure.
When Amazon takes over something as mundane as delivery driving, that all of a sudden creates a colony economics.
Yeah. Well, I was going to get into the whole point of wages in real terms and the importance of supporting local economies, because local economies are not controlled by a central government, and we have much more say in a local economy-driven environment. So,
sure.
Thank you for that caller. I don't generally take calls before 7:30, so I was kind of a little bit caught out, but I don't normally like to turn people down. So Dr. Pete will be joining us fairly soon. I just wanted to get through with what I've started as an introduction here. I just wanted to get at the point that the cost of living has rapidly increased. And one other thing, in 1950 at the University of Pennsylvania, annual tuition was $600. So the tuition to income ratio there was 0.18. Current tuition is $40,000 a year, and the tuition to income ratio now is 0.79. That's 4.3 times, and student loans are fueling all of that. So this massive increase in student loans and debt amounts to about $1 trillion at present, which in and of itself may show us as a crisis in time to come. U.S. total debt in 2001 was $28 trillion, folks. In 2012, it was $68 trillion. With global debt, now get this, global debt is currently at $217 trillion, or over 327% of global GDP. So three times the annual complete output would not pay for the debt. So according to the Economic Policy Institute, entry-level wages of male and female college graduates has remained the same since 1973. So if you had a college graduate, you had a graduate degree in 73, you'd be entering the market at the same kind of wage as you'd be entering the market now, with a 4.3 times increase in the cost to get your education. But more disconcertingly, the entry-level wages for male and female high school graduates from 73 to 2011 has dropped dramatically from $16 an hour in 73 to $12 an hour now. So between that time from 73 to now, it's dropped $4. And in real terms, everything is at least double, if not more. So why is this relevant then, you might ask yourself, or ask your herb doctor to have this as a subject? But it's very relevant. As a disposable income we have as employees or self-employed producers of goods or services is what we use to make lifestyle choices that ultimately has a ripple effect across the world. Now, sustainable agriculture and animal farming practices using organic production methods should create the best product possible, without a doubt, hands down, no equals. It's only that this classification is now used as a trendy phrase for what was commonly done prior to the industrialization of foods, and from the 1900s on has itself fallen, in some cases, victim to the greed and corruption plaguing non-organic production, especially mass production of organic products, including but not limited to milk production, which is what I'll get into with Dr. Pete in just a minute. So it has both a psychological and physical effect, a truly holistic unifying theorem, which for economic sake and greed is being reduced to the lowest common denominator, a given form by massive corporate control of agribusiness and truly unimaginable scale production of corporate food globally. From animal factory farming to mega arable farming, none of which is organically produced and all of which is degrading the environment. So, Dr. Pete, are you there with us?
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. Well, we had an early caller there, and I was actually wanted to get your take on what he'd said. I don't know if you heard his question, and you don't have to answer it, but I guess first things first, can I just get you to outline your academic and professional background and career for those people who perhaps have never heard you?
I did my undergraduate study at 1953 to 56, and I had a summer job where I made $500, and with a tuition scholarship, that paid for my 9 months of schooling every
wow.
year.
Wow.
And I looked at the prices recently, and it was about at least 20 times more expensive.
Wow.
I couldn't afford to go to school currently, where it was something that really average and low-income people could afford in the 1950s.
I wasn't going to ask you this, but I mean, I don't mean it rudely in any way, but how, you are 81 or?
81.
Yeah. Okay, so now you would be a good candidate to ask this question because you've been around for 81 years, right? Which is pretty respectable in its own right. Now, you've obviously seen, and I wasn't going to ask you this, but I'd love you to answer it because you've seen it and been through it, but you've seen the economics change in America here over the last 80 years and the cost of things increase the way they have. What do you think about what I mentioned earlier in the show as the intro for the kind of median house price, the average car price, and then the average wage? And what do you think about high school graduates losing $4 an hour from 1973 to now, let alone getting any kind of increase to account for inflation? And then graduate students are still on the same hourly wage from 73 as they are to now. How do you feel about the economics? And then we'll get into, I think, what I wanted to question you about.
A lot of popular culture has to do with keeping people from realizing things are getting worse and worse.
Good point.
For example, you were mentioning the average income. Those are actually the median income.
Mm-hmm.
The actual per capita average income in the U.S. for one person is $58,000 or $59,000 a year. For a family of 2.54 people, the average household size, the average family income then is almost $150,000 a year. But since the newspapers and almost everyone refers to the average income, actually using the median income, which it neglects the vast incomes that the upper 1 or 2% are making.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
And since the gold standard was thrown out, the government has had to keep the illusion going. They're increasingly hiding information. They used to give out the figures for the money supply. A few years ago, they stopped giving out much of the information that had been routine. So the reason the stock market seems to be going up is really because the government is pumping money into it, basically corrupting the money.
Yeah,
phony money.
This is by having central banks that are basically able to print money without any penalty, basically. The money's worthless, and yet people are still buying it. People are still buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Still buying U.S. debt and debt, and the oil. Oil is still pegged to the dollar, which is why the whole petrodollar thing was coming under scrutiny, and it still is. And the Chinese were perhaps trying to break away from it. And I know it's in a lot of conspiracy circles, at least the reason why Muammar Gaddafi basically was wanting his population to be free, and he was socializing them, and the Muslim population there was being very westernized and actually not at all radicalized, and how he was going to use fairly large reserves of gold that he had to go back to the gold standard and get into trading oil in Libya with gold, and actually, I think, starting to encourage the other Arab nations to do the same. And this is when he was taken out, and this is the whole...
It was the same with Saddam Hussein.
Right.
He was trying to get off the petrodollar, and Venezuela is doing the same.
Exactly. And then look at them. They've all been either taken over, or their government's been supplanted, or their country's been thrown into civil war. Okay, so I guess without getting too far off the topic, looking at the cost of everything, as human beings, you know, I mean, I'd like to believe that the bulk of people have got good intentions. The bulk of people are not just warlike, grab as much as they can, evil, despotic people who do anything to get above the next person, and that we have probably more than ever and a consciousness of the world that we live in, which wants to try and level the playing field between the poor and the rich, because it's such a huge gulf now with so few people owning so much and the rest of the population basically being, I think, their cost of living, their standard of living being lowered in real terms. So looking at, I know I read your newsletter and you mentioned in part of it Vernadsky and Teilhard de Chardin starting the concepts of the noosphere and the biosphere. And so as organisms, as human beings, you know, we are living in this biosphere and very much subject to the stresses that we get, you know, that are made known to us either through television or advertising or obviously debt. And I think debt is, at this point, has the biggest chain around most people's necks that stops them looking sideways.
Relating to Vernadsky, he was looking at the planet as a metabolic system. The biosphere was, he saw the soil and the atmosphere and the solar energy being converted to food and living substance. His concept really saw carbon dioxide as a promoter of life and increasing the quality of living. And I see the current fear of carbon dioxide as partly a distraction from the actual pollution. Deforestation is one of the major causes of the carbon dioxide increase, but it's actually doing much, actually doing damage rather than the carbon dioxide increase that they're talking about. It's degrading the rivers. The oceans are being degraded by the petroleum spills and chemical runoff from the use of mass chemicals in agriculture. But the propaganda machine, for example, the website Politico, it was funded by money from the biggest bank in Washington, D.C., and it represents the ruling class ideology. An article that was came out on Politico a few weeks ago was written by a mathematician saying that he had demonstrated that the rising carbon dioxide was going to degrade the food supply by stimulating the growth of plants. And his reasoning was that it was based on a complete upside-down version of what happens when you shine light on plankton. It stimulates the growth of the plant part, the algae, and absorbs carbon dioxide and suppresses the growth of the animal part of the plankton. And he said that that was analogous to the stimulation of plant growth by carbon dioxide. But what actually happens in the first part of his explanation, the plant growth stimulation by the sunlight steals carbon dioxide that would make minerals available to the animals. So it's the carbon dioxide deficiency that he started from to argue that a carbon dioxide excess would do the same thing. So he was completely unbiological and backwards in his reasoning, but that went around. Many other media picked it up, and argued that it's really degrading the food supply to stimulate growth with carbon dioxide. But Vernadsky was exactly right. The carbon dioxide is part of the soil-forming process. The plants secrete acids from their roots to dissolve minerals, but the carbon dioxide carried into the soil from the atmosphere is part of the process of making minerals more available to plants. So the mass media are still promoting myths to confuse the argument, make people worry about a false process.
Get them looking in the opposite direction.
Or the real pollution.
I think what you said captured that when you mentioned the fact that it's in the American government's machine interest to steer people away from looking too hard in the right direction and not publishing a lot of figures that you mentioned in terms of financial fiscal figures, especially to do with government debt. Well, we hear about the government debt a lot, but there's a lot of other features of banking and finance that we don't hear about these days that used to be published. And I think I was thinking when that caller called in about Nixon and the gold standard in 72, that Nixon got taken out not long after being involved in politics by that Watergate scandal, which is nothing compared to what's going on now, what has happened in the last few years. It would make Watergate look like a complete tea party. So, Dr. P, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the economic side of it. I was thinking earlier that in terms of real wages, in terms of what is the disposable part of your income and what it is that we do as people with our disposable income. And knowing that, I think most people, maybe it's just me, maybe I'm just coming from a single-sided perspective here, but I would have thought most people would think that certified organic production is the better option over industrialized farming, and that certified soil practices are better for the earth, and that sustainable and local derived products are better for the environment in general, and that with our disposable income, we could put our money where our mouth is and buy those things and support those ideals and those products and boycott those mega corporations that we don't want to do business with. But that the actual real cost of our disposable income has gone down so much, and the government, I think, largely through not releasing these kind of figures to make it obvious to us, have really kept a lot of people in the dark. And I think when so many people are burdened with student loans, where they've gone through an education that's basically worthless, and they've spent thousands and thousands of dollars trying to study something that hopefully they had a passion for in the first place, and they weren't just looking for a better wage from a higher paying job, but they suddenly find themselves in a marketplace with tens of thousands of other qualified people all earning a vastly lower wage than they were in the 70s, and with much greater debt than they ever had before. So what do you think of that?
Even the health statistics, for example, longevity and disease incidence, these are being falsified. In the 90s, the government declared that it had won the war on cancer.
Right.
And at the time, 94, I pointed out that the Secretary of Health was using phony statistics. And looking at the figures, I predicted that they would have to change the rules by the end of the century, because the way they were falsifying the statistics, the arrival of the baby boom population bulge, by the year 2000, the cancer rate of this huge population bulge was going to make it impossible to keep up the illusion that longevity was increasing, that cancer was decreasing, and so on. And exactly, I think it was the year 2000, the U.S. Bureau of Statistics changed the rules and stopped giving out the raw figures, and have only age-standardized figures on health and longevity and age-specific death rates and so on. So people are really being put into a dream world in which nothing is real.
Yeah. We do have a caller. Let's get this next caller before we continue that thread. Caller, you're on the airway from, what's your question?
I'm from Locksburg area.
Okay. What's your question?
Yes, I had a medical question. It somewhat pertains to what you're talking about, but is that all right to ask a question?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I had called back years ago, and I had this lump on my neck, and Dr. Pettit suggested eating carrots and other things and not going to any kind of a CAT scan or anything like that. So this went on for years, and it ended up being a cancer tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it removed in Mexico and then came up here and went through chemo and radiation. And my medical question is a year later now, I was cutting a small amount of poison oak, and I thought I had poison oak on me, and all of a sudden this huge rash went over my shoulder and down around the area where the tumor was. And fortunately, my girlfriend had gone online, like you were mentioning, the information online, and saw that maybe it was shingles, which I had no idea about.
Right.
And I wonder if Dr. Pete could talk a little bit about that and if that actually was related to the radiation treatment and chemo.
Sure. Well, it would lower your resistance for sure. And shingles can be reactivated chickenpox at any point in a person's life, especially if they're under stress. I wanted to ask you, caller, first things first, before I go any further, what was the cancer that they identified?
You know, I'm so confused with names, but it was some sort of a skin type cancer.
So it's like
a unusual for this lump to be there, and it took about 12 to 15 years to develop into this massive lump on my neck that was actually breaking out and coming out of my skin.
So it was a benign cancer in some terms, and it wasn't metastasizing, it wasn't spreading. It took 12 years to evolve.
And then finally it got so bad that that local doctors wouldn't touch it or try to cut it out, so I had to go through chemo and all these different things. But it's somewhat much better now, a little swelling there.
Okay.
And so, I was just wondering if that had something to do with the shingles, or if I should go and consult a doctor. It's going away now after about a week. But it looked just like a bad case of poison oak.
Okay, was it extremely sensitive to the touch?
Very sensitive, but not very itchy like poison oak would have been.
Was it in a defined... I'll just jump in very quickly before I let Dr. Pete answer, but I'm just kind of interested. Dr. Pete probably won't agree with this even. I've always been taught that shingles is a defined dermatomal area that can, along the length of the nerve, erupt into a vesicular outbreak. But Dr. Pete, let me ask you, because I know you've got probably a very different approach to what this gentleman was talking about.
Just in case it's actually poison oak, I had the experience in my teens of being extremely sensitive to poison oak. I was working in the woods for the Bureau of Land Management and could hardly stand. My sleep was interrupted by extreme poison oak. And the word went around the camp that vitamin C, which was new on the market, it was just fairly expensive, coming out in 50-milligram tablets. The word went around that vitamin C protected against poison oak. So at the end of the week, I bought a bottle, took a few tablets, 50 or 100 milligrams, and suddenly the poison oak disappeared, and I never had it again.
Wow.
65 years later.
I'm not really sensitive to poison oak. I've been here for about 40 years. I get it just a little bit, but it was like just a little bit, and by a day or two later, my whole shoulder and down my back turned into these huge bubbles, these blackening bubbles. And I've been familiar with poison oak. Usually it's blotchy, and if you itch it, it gets worse and worse. But this was like just a takeover of my skin, and Is that very...
I had that form of a bubbly and crispy crust.
Yeah, yeah. Just turn all down my back and stuff. On one side of my body, though. It's not on any other place. Just all over the one side shoulder, underneath my neck, down my chest a bit. And now it's getting better. I've been eating organically for years and years, so I assumed that my diet really helped. And then we put, like, witch hazel on there, too. To calm it down, and some neem oil and other things. So is it something that you should pay a lot of attention to later on, or will it go away and just be gone?
If it's poison oak, it's possible that you'll never suffer from it again. If it's a virus, shingles, I think it's a good idea to have your vitamin D level checked. Vitamin D is a very powerful antiviral. It mm-hmm. regulates all the levels of your immune system. Your serum level should be in the middle of the range, around 50 nanograms per milliliter.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, do have two more.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, caller. We've got two more callers, so let's take the next caller. Caller, where are you from? What's your question?
Hi, I'm from the New York City area.
Okay, and what's your question?
I was wondering if Dr. Pete had any advice on finding dentists to use the filling materials he recommends, which, from what I read, was calcium oxide for root canals and soro cements for regular fillings, and how should I understand the importance of those materials?
Dr. P, filling material for teeth, what's your current?
For the root canal, I think the calcium, it's antiseptic and anesthetic, and it's traditional but safer than the gutta percha or metal fillings. And I think the composite fillings are now high enough in strength that they're good for even the chewing teeth.
Okay.
Do you have any advice on finding dentists to use those? Because I think I've emailed like dozens of people and haven't found much results of that.
I've for about 50 years had all my dentistry done in Mexico because they emphasize skill, dexterity, and care rather than speed and profit.
So it could be worth a trip to Mexico purely for dentistry. I know lots of people do it for medical issues like surgeries, but okay. Well, we do have another caller on the air. Let's get this next caller. So caller,
hello.
Yeah, where are you from, and what's your question?
Yes, I'm from Phillipsville, and more than a question, I have a comment. The fellow that was talking about getting poison oak and then it turning into shingles, but he talked about having cancer, having this lump that grew and became very large, and he had to have all kinds of cancer therapies to get rid of it. And you made a comment saying that because it hadn't metastasized, you refer to it as a benign cancer.
Mm-hmm.
That's an oxymoron. There is no such thing as benign cancer. There is a benign tumor, but benign means it's not cancer.
Self-contained.
If you have
a lump and
it's cancer, they call it malignant. If it's a lump that is not cancer, they call it benign. So there's no such thing as benign cancer. So what are we talking about?
Okay, well, I don't need to go there with that. I don't need to defend myself.
What was that?
I don't think I need to defend myself with that.
Don't think you need to explain why you referred to cancer as benign when there's no such thing?
Well, if you look at moles are cancers, but they are benign when they're still...
There's a precancerous condition
mm-hmm.
which hasn't developed into cancer. But if it's cancer, it's malignant. It's not benign.
A lot of the language used medically in relation to cancer has been to promote the business of the oncologists. 50 or 60 years ago, cancers were things that were definitely identified as benign. The language was escalated so that something which formerly was not cancer was called pre-cancer and then cancer. If you use the language of 1940, many cancers wouldn't exist that are now officially named as cancer.
And treatable
but
and profitable.
But don't they refer to cancer as malignant and a tumor that's not cancer as benign?
An article in JAMA about 40 years ago looked at the evidence of the pathology methods of analyzing the properties of the cytoplasm, nucleus ratio, and the matter of disorganization and invasion and so on. And in this article, it was demonstrated that a healing wound, if it's biopsied, will show all of the properties that are used by the pathologist to identify cancer. What is defined as cancer has become more inclusive, and if you happen to have an injury that gets biopsied, it'll be called cancer because it has the properties of rapid growth, invasive appearance, and so on.
Well, then, is that benign or malignant?
This article was pointing out that you can't tell, that the only way you can tell if something is going to be malignant is wait and see.
Well,
if
you told this fellow not to go to the doctor when his lump was small, and he took your advice, and it grew and grew and grew and became cancer, and he had to have all kinds of difficult therapy. They couldn't even remove it. He had to have chemotherapy to shrink it before they could even remove it. Why did you tell him not to go to a doctor when he first had it?
I don't remember saying that. I don't think I ever tell people not to go to doctors.
I don't think he did either. I think
well,
been...
I misunderstood that because I thought he said he had spoken with you when he first got it and that you had told him not to go to a doctor.
I never tell people not to go to doctors, but I tell them to think and question what the doctor tells them to do.
Well, that's
all right. Well,
thanks
for the call. It sounds like a more of a battle of words here. Okay, we've got two more calls. So let's take the next caller. Caller, where are you from? What's your question?
I'm in Whitethorn. I have a comment and a question. My first comment for the prior caller is the best dentist I have ever seen is James Mattson in Fort Bragg.
Okay, James Mattson in Fort Bragg.
Yeah, Dr. Mattson.
Okay, all right.
Lasers. Super high-tech, very professional, very soothing, great, great dentist, best one I've ever seen.
Okay.
My other question, though, is about sclerosing mesenteritis. Are there any herbs that might help, you know, dissolve the internal scar tissue?
Dissolving internal scar tissue. Yeah. Yeah, a little difficult in terms of any tissue that's truly become fibrotic. And has been organized that way to do that. It's not that easy. I don't know, Dr. P, if you're looking at scar tissue, I know there are some things that they have said in the past are good for dissolving scars, but I think once tissue's gotten as organized as a proper scar with those fibrin and connectins, I think they're fairly insoluble. Well, maybe something like progesterone might be useful in that case.
I've had experience with some fibrotic lumps and scars. For example, vitamin E. I had a vaccination scar from the time I was 18 until I was in my 40s. It was bulgy and red, and I put vitamin E on it, and in a week it had essentially disappeared, but a very hard lump sometimes takes 6 months or so of anti-inflammatory vitamin E, progesterone, total nutrition improvement can accelerate the
vitamin
tissue.
E orally.
Vitamin E topically, Dr. B.
Oh, in the case of a scar in your skin, yes.
Oh, no, it's inside.
Yeah.
Sclerosing mesenteritis.
Yeah, so that would have to be taken internally. But do you think, Dr. Pete, that vitamin E taken internally would really have any topical effect on that, or do you think it...
No. But the a lot of the sclerosing problems are calcification, abnormal calcification, and Hans Selye pioneered the study of how to cause and regress calcified tissue, various types of sclerosis, and that's a good place to start. But vitamin D and the high calcium intake to lower your parathyroid hormone is part of the process of reversing calcified tissue. Vitamin K is another anti-soft tissue calcification factor.
What was the name of the person you said had studied this? Ken?
Hans Selye, S-E-L-Y-E?
Yes,
S-E-L-Y-E.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. All right, there's another caller, so let's get this next caller. Caller, where are you from, and what's your question?
From Kansas City.
Kansas City.
I was just wondering. I've been listening to a lot of your old podcasts and the thyroid issues, and I didn't hear this particular question in them. I was diagnosed with Graves' disease, which is supposed to be hyperthyroid, but I've never been hyperthyroid, and I was wondering. And the only way they diagnosed me, was because I had the eyes and the swelling in the feet and the legs.
So you had exophthalmos?
And I was wondering, because I've been on thyroid hormone for years, and I still have issues. And I was wondering, would you treat that differently than someone that, say, had Hashimoto's? Because I've still got elevated antibodies and all of that.
Yeah. So, Dr. Pete, Graves' disease with exophthalmos, I'm pretty sure it's a kind of common presenting complaint. And she said swollen feet?
I had the swelling on the tops of the feet and the front of the shins. I still have some of the swelling.
But you see, bulging eyes was one of the main presenting complaints, she said.
Pitting edema, I think they call it.
I think a more thorough metabolic study would show something other than the anti-thyroid antibodies. You would want to check the steroid hormones, progesterone, cortisol, vitamin D, and the actual level of your thyroid hormones, the T3 and T4, and reverse T3. Lots of people...
I did check all of those. I have a new doctor, and we checked all of those, and the only thing that I was low on was testosterone. And it wasn't that low. It was just a little low, so... And I've been on vitamin D supplements for 5 years, and it's in the normal. I mean, it's usually between 60 and 80 in that range. I don't seem to be able to find anything that I can get a handle on.
Have you changed your temperature or pulse rate in response to the thyroid?
No, my temperature is usually between 96.6 and 97 when I wake up in the morning. But then it goes up during the day. Like, it might go up to 99 by the end of the day.
That is really not consistent with Graves' disease. And most of the people, I've only seen one person that I think really had hyperthyroid Graves' disease, but I've talked to many people who had the diagnosis, and some of their doctors said, well, actually, they're both hypothyroid and hyperthyroid. But they were...
Yeah, that's what they tell me. They tell me I have Hashimoto's and Graves now, because I have all of the thyroid antibodies very high. And I'm on 4 1/3 grains of natural thyroid, and all of my numbers come back right. But, my temperature is all whacked out. I still have some of the swelling. I just don't know what to do next.
Have you changed the thyroid dose while watching your pulse rate and temperature and requirement for calories?
You mean like taking something that's a fast-acting thyroid, like T3? Because the T4 doesn't act very fast. I mean,
the T3 acts within an hour and a half.
No one's ever given me a T3 supplement. Like, you mean like a Cytomel or something?
Yeah.
So how would you do that? Then you would take some Cytomel, and then you would watch for what?
Do you divide your natural thyroid supplement and take it in fractions during the day?
No, because they told me that the T4 part of it, you had to take it 4 hours apart from any other medication and apart from food and everything. So I take it first thing in the morning.
Did they explain why you should do that?
They said something about the minerals binding the T4 or something. I don't quite understand it.
Since it takes a couple of days for anything to pass through the intestine normally, sometimes longer, there's plenty of time for the T4 to absorb, and your body doesn't want it to absorb all in an hour or two. When it does that, it induces enzymes in your liver which destroy it. If the liver perceives this huge unphysiological surge of T4 coming in just an hour, it's going to eliminate it 12 hours later, so that you'll actually be hypothyroid 12 hours after you take it.
I'm going to have to stop you both there, I'm afraid. We're getting 2 minutes to the top of the hour, and I've got to wrap up with some information to let people know more about you, Dr. Pete, and also just to generally close out the rest of the show. So thanks for those people that have joined us tonight. Thank you, Dr. Pete, for your time. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks for all the callers. For anybody else who has listened to the show, wants to know more about Dr. Pete, he's got a website, www.raypete.com. He's not selling anything, but he's got some very good scholarly articles that are fully referenced on lots of subjects that you probably not even heard about, and some of the reasons why what you think is good for you is not good for you, and the science behind it. So like you said at the beginning of the show there, before I even asked you about it, the government want to keep a lot of this stuff quiet, and they want to steer you in a general direction. You're more manageable that way. Once you can be burdened with debt and you pay your taxes, you don't have too much time to think about too much, so you're quite controllable. Anyway, for those people that have listened to the show, thanks so much for joining us. We can be reached 1-888-WBM-ERB for further questions, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And for those of you who've listened tonight, keep your ears and eyes open. You know, things are not quite the way you think they are sometimes. And if you're looking in a radical new direction, chances are you may well find some fruit. Okay, so till next month, next October, we're in the fall. Happy fall to you all.